satellite that went up the end of last year, and that thing is now almost activated, but it won't be 100% activated for probably another, 10 months. But this is the one with the 6 meter diameter antenna. But the unusual, we have spacecraft up there with 60 foot diameter antennas. But the thing that's unusual about this one was that this thing was spinning around. They got it up to on the 23rd. They got it up to 4 revolutions per minute. The goal is to eventually get it just over 14 revolutions per minute. So, but all is going well, and the SMAP mission is doing quite good. I just wanted to bring an update on that. It was the Soil Moisture Active Passive Observatory. That thing's good. And, with this net, there's so many different launches to cover, so I'm not able to cover half these things that go up. For instance,
repeater, timeout.
For instance, last week alone, it was half a dozen launches. You had Japan had a launch, classified mission, with an optical scope on it. You had another one launched from the United States on a Delta IV, bringing up another GPS satellite. You had the Soyuz rocket that launched from French Guiana, which brought up two GPS satellites, Galileo GPS, that's the European version of our GPS system. They've been launching them. And then you had Scott Kelly and two Russians that went up to the International Space Station. So all these missions are really almost impossible to cover on the net. I just wanted to bring up the one from the Ukraine. I thought it was interesting. The Russians trying to actually eventually get away from the Ukraine. Ukraine were big builders of these rockets during the heyday of the Soviet Union. And they still are. But they've gotten away from the problems. But the Russians have, 3 or 4 different launch sites that they could use throughout Russia. They're building a new one. But the Ukraine still wants to launch their own rockets. And they have one here called the Dnieper. It's Slavic speaking country, so I'm not sure what it means. But it's a leftover from the Cold War. They had all these silos all throughout the country, and Ukraine had these silos, and these missiles, these Dnieper rockets, they now use for space launches to put satellites up in space. So, the other day, they launched, the Ukraine got a chance to launch one of their rockets, and they happened to be launching a satellite for Korea. Korea wanted one. So, Korea paid them to launch it. It's a 3-stage rocket. I mean, to get out of this silo, I mean, they have the door that opens up, just like you're going to be attacked by a nuclear missile, that door pops open. There's a charge of black powder that goes off at the bottom of this thing. It's got some kind of a plate, apparently, on the bottom of it, and it's protecting the engines. And that charge blows this 60-foot rocket hood out of the silo. Right after it leaves the silo, its first main boosters ignite, and then they have these rings of O-rings surrounding the circumference of the rocket, which acted as a seal inside the silo. And this thing takes off from dropping. On the way to orbit, launches the second stage. Then the final stage, which is this long rocket, going up into space. And usually you have a third stage. It'll push it along to its location, No, they have. This thing is again a leftover of the Cold War. It has little rocket boosters, which maneuvering rockets, which turn it around. It turns it around 180 degrees. I don't know if you ever saw one of these things, Dick. And then it's got four rockets actually facing the wrong direction toward the point of the rocket. But now that this thing made 180 degrees, these four rockets ignite, and it's actually pulling the rocket up into its final orbit. Incredible. And the reason they did that was for, you know, they were going to launch, you know, three or four nuclear bombs out of this thing years ago, and it would have been more accurate to let one go at a time. So it would have been easier to just drop it off as, you know, okay, this is a good place to let one go, and then another one, and then another one. So because of this system, they still have it in place. They utilized it, and they put this Korean spacecraft into orbit. Interesting concept. I had to bring that one up. But we can't cover all these launches. That's impossible. I go through this day to day, and I try to come up with the most interesting, talkable topics that we could possibly come up with. K2RIWWS2N.
Sounded good. I did the recalculation. Water molecule, two hydrogens and an oxygen. Each oxygen has an atomic number of 8. That means it's got 8 protons, but it's also got 8 neutrons. So each oxygen molecule has an atomic weight of 16. 16 for the oxygen, 2 for the hydrogen is 18. So water molecule, 88% or 89% of it is the weight of oxygen. And when you're bringing things into space, the mass of the material is the first thing you got to worry about, because you got to accelerate it with rocket power. And the second thing is volume. So when you're bringing up oxygen in the form of water, almost all the mass is the oxygen, and it's about as compact as you're going to get the oxygen. It's the equivalent of putting it into very high pressure cylinders. So I'm getting the impression from what you're telling me that with this module, with the electrolysis process converting oxygen into hydrogen and converting water into oxygen and hydrogen, and then the oxygen itself is primarily what they breathe. I'm getting the impression, Paul, that the majority of the oxygen the astronauts are breathing comes up on a cargo ship in the form of water and gets electrolyzed into oxygen, and that's what they're breathing. That not as much of the oxygen is coming up in compressed oxygen cylinders. Do you see it that way, Paul? K2RIW?
I do. Yeah. You ever watch them unload these, all of them, and there's always bags and bags and bags of water. If you look at multi-purpose module that's attached to the space station. They used to bring this thing up and down in the back of the space shuttle and cargo. I mean, it was the size of a full module that you would leave docked in the space station. And now they use it as a basement. You know, they put tons of stuff and supplies and extra stuff in this particular module. And then they showed somebody go into it. It looks like they could barely move down it. It's bags and bags of water. And then as they pass from one module to another, some of the nodes, they call them nodes, it's where they sleep. And that was, you couldn't even, it looked like they couldn't even get past them when they were trying to go from one module to the other. It was all bags and bags of water things on that. Yeah, not only are they drinking with it, using it for a lot of different purposes. It's the main purpose of for bringing it up is probably drinking and oxygen. So, back to you.
I've done another very quick back-of-the-envelope calculation, Paul. A cubic meter of air is a little bit more than 1 kilogram of material. 1 liter of water is 1 kilogram of water. So 1 liter of water, and you separate the oxygen and convert it into breathable oxygen, it's going to give you very close to a cubic meter of oxygen. So bringing up water as a method of bringing up oxygen gives you a compactness ratio of a little bit less than 1,000 to 1. In other words, 1 liter of water, when it's completely vaporized by electrolysis, gives you more than, it gives you approximately 1 cubic meter, 1,000 times more volume. You save in volume 1,000 to 1 when you bring up water as opposed to bringing up oxygen that hasn't been compressed. Let me drop it.
I've read 1.3 liters for breathable air for one person. Does that sound right?
Well, each individual breath is approximately 1 liter of air. But 1 liter of water is going to make close to 1,000 liters of air. You see that ratio, Paul? You save an awful lot by bringing up water. And earlier you mentioned that there was a Soyuz trip which didn't dock immediately. It took an extra couple of days. What was wrong there? They got into the wrong orbit and it took them long to correct it, and they were glad they had enough oxygen on board to survive that. What happened on that mission, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
I think that was the one where the Soyuz, I guess it would be their third stage, went a couple of seconds too long or something of that nature. Just put them slightly out of range. So they had to maneuver and take the long road. minor mishap, but that's all it takes. It has to be a highly accurate maneuver to do what they do, and they did it successfully for the last flight, for the last crew. And I bet they're happy about it. It really looks like close quarters. You know, although they could float to the front, you know, and move around quite a bit. You know, there's three sections on the Soyuz spacecraft. They're in the middle. That's where they are when they take off, and that's where they are when they land. The module in front of them is the docking module, and you can have like living quarters. That's where their bathroom is. But I'm sure that's packed full of stuff, so kind of cramped quarters until they get to the space station.
Now, let me backtrack. What were you saying about 1 liter of breathable air? Each breath that you take is close to 1 liter of air of a normal-sized breath, if you're not, you know, breathing real deeply. And so 1,000 of those breaths is close to 1 cubic meter of air, and 1 cubic meter of air is what you approximately get when you take 1 liter of water and convert it into oxygen. Is that approximately what you were saying earlier, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, I think they said 1.3 liters of water. You convert that to air. That's what the average guy needs. You're saying it's way more than that? I seem to remember 1.3 was the average. You know, you take that liter of water and convert that to air, well, oxygen and hydrogen. Get rid of most of the hydrogen, and don't forget that oxygen is only 20% of what you're really breathing. The other 80% almost is nitrogen.
And I'm guessing the nitrogen is just simply recycled. You don't use that very much. Now, you're saying a human being uses 1.3 liters of water per watt, per day, per hour?
If you told per day, I read per day.
Okay, 1.3 liters of water. Now, this is for potable water for drinking, or you're talking about 1.3 liters of water is the breathable oxygen after electrolysis. Is that what you're saying?
And I'm trying to go back to what I remember reading when I read this thing a number of times. 1.3 liters of water turns into breathable air, so that's what I think it was. So that's what you need. In other words, you're going to go through, based on that, 9 and 10 liters of water for the, a crew of six to breathe. Is that per day? Is that right?
Okay, let's see if that is. 1.3 liters of water is going to make approximately 1 cubic meter of oxygen. But oxygen is only 1/5 of what you believe of what you breathe. So if I change that by a 5-to-1 ratio, and I add nitrogen to it, I'm now getting 5 cubic meters of breathable air, if it was at standard temperature and pressure. If a person takes a breath of roughly 1 liter of air, that's 1,000 breaths per cubic meter. That's 5,000 breaths per 5 cubic meters. So do we breathe 5,000 breaths in 24 hours? I think the average person breathes, what, 20 breaths per minute? 5,000 breaths is how many hours? It sounds like it's coming out very close. So you're saying 1.3 liters of water is what's needed to make the 20% oxygen breathable air for one man for one day. Sounds about right. So therefore, as you were estimating, 7 or 8 liters of water per day maintains that crew, and you've seen them bring up a whole lot of bags of water. Make a guess as to how much water they were bringing up all. That tells us roughly how long is the life of that stuff.
Oh, I don't know. You know, they'll bring up 5,000 pounds of stuff, let's say, in a progress mission. They break it down. I could find it on the internet, but they break it down. How much is food? How much is water? But, you know, water was a big number. Of course, the fuel was always included. So I think probably 50-50 with the fuel and water. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was over 1,000 pounds of water each time, each gallon of water is, what, 8.3 pounds, so you can imagine how many gallons that is. quite a bit thick. Don't forget, this is all coming back to water. Not at all. You know, this is only, it's an active machine, a temperature machine. That's what I wanted to bring up. This thing has broken down a number of times. It was brought up probably around 2009, maybe 2000. Yeah, probably 2009. So since it's been up there by the space shuttle.
I got a question now, Paul. If something goes wrong and they can't make any more cargo ship launches, and you have to just use what's on board the space station, if no consumable materials can be brought up, how much is in the storeroom? Are they good for, let me pick a number, 3 or 4 months, and just what's on board for both boosting and food and water and oxygen? If there was no progress for the next 4 months, would everything just run out after about 4 months? Is there a guess on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
I think it's 6 month reserve for a crew of six. Naturally longer if problems happen when it's a crew of three. Right now it's a crew of six. So you gotta remember, every time somebody comes up, there's a Soyuz spacecraft that's permanently attached for the next 6 months. They come up with it and usually go back with it. And that's what's going to happen here. So they're good to go for 6 months. There's another flight going up in about 3 months. Then another one after that. By the way, this flight was put on CNN and Fox News, which you don't see too many flights making the news that much. But because of Kelly going up, they made a big deal out of it. They'll probably make a bigger deal out of, or not as big a deal, but in 6 months when Sarah Brightman goes up, she's a space tourist, and that should be interesting. They're going back to space tourism. They haven't done that since 2009. Back to Dick.
Is 6 astronauts the maximum they've ever had for any significant duration on the International Space Station? I mean, there's six up there right now. The very next launch of three means that for a short period of time there'll be nine before three go back down. And I am guessing they recycle the Soyuz spacecrafts. In other words, the one that comes up is the one that's going to stay there. The one that's been there for a while is the Soyuz that's going to come back down. You don't want to artificially age those Soyuz. So will there be nine astronauts on board for a brief period of time? And is that the maximum they've ever had, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
That has been for a short period of time, very short. But maybe a week or something, as far as I remember. But you'll have, next time around, you'll have three going down. You have Samantha, Christopher, Audie, she's from Italy, the European Space Agency. She's due to come down, I think, 3 months from now with her two partners. And then right after that, a week or so after that, you'll have another launch. So, you're going between three and six. I think the one in September when they bring up the Space Tourist is when they'll have nine temporarily for maybe 10 days, and then they'll time it that way, and then that crew will go back down. Two people will be going down, and then they'll be taking the Space Tourist with them. They don't stay for 6 months.
Yeah, I think you said the next tourist is Sarah Brightman. Roughly how long will she be there? A couple of weeks or a couple of days? And what is that tourism going to cost her, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, she'll be going up probably 7 to 10 days, just like the last guy there. The last guy was a guy who owns Circus Olay. He went up, that was 2009. But this, she's going up, here we are all these years later, and they decided to do it again because now there's going to be a few more openings. For instance, you have two people now doing a year on board, so that tends to open up a seat here and there. Instead of the six-month flights, the two guys that are going up, they'll probably take her down. I would think something like that. I'd have to figure it out. But that's pretty much what they're going to do. And if anybody's ever seen her, she's really quite a singer. Known worldwide. Back to you, Dick.
What's your guess as to what this trip is costing her, Paul? Is it published?
No, but they estimated. This goes through Space Adventures, and it comes out of Virginia. Go down there, sign up with them. Paid them roughly about $50 million, 50. I think the earlier flights, like when Dennis Tito went up and Shuttleworth from Shuttleworth was South Africa. He was a tech guy. He had a lot of money. I think they were in a $40 million dollar group, but the price went up a little bit. What gets me when we send our astronauts up, for instance, Kelly, it cost us $70 million, 70. So what are we paying more for?
Well, he's going to be there for a long time. He's got a specially made spacesuit. My guess is she has a shuttle launch suit, which is not quite a full spacesuit. A shuttle launch suit, as opposed to a full custom-made spacesuit. I think each of those spacesuits are essentially custom-made for the particular astronaut. Although maybe they've got three or four different sizes. How does that work, Paul? Go ahead.
The early days, 100% for each astronaut. But now it's, some of the things, like the gloves and things like that, are specifically designed for each astronaut. But whether it is a small, medium, and large, I don't know. But I know it's not as exactly as it used to be. The spacewalk, that's different. You have two different spaces. You have the ones you go up with, although they're capable of somewhat doing an EVA, but in an emergency, the big white spaces that you see on the space station when they're doing a spacewalk. That's designed specifically for them. I know Kelly has to have one. I don't know if they set one up with him. He's going to do a spacewalk. He's going to hook up the NASA docking adapter. That's preparation for the commercial flights when Boeing starts sending up their CST-100 and SpaceX sends up their crewed Dragon. It's an adapter that they've got a bolt on the outside of the PMA. Pressure mating adapter that's already up there. Back to you, Dick.
$50 million. That rolls off the tongue easily. She must be selling an awful lot of records, Paul. Wow. If you could afford it, would you go for 10 days onto the space station, Paul?
No. Yeah, when I was younger, yeah, sure. Why not? But to afford that, you got to be rich. You know, she's made plenty of money on her own. She used to be married to Lloyd Webber. He wrote all those plays. Multi-billionaire, probably. So, you got all that money. Go for it, Dick.
John, if you could afford it, would you take a 10-day trip to the International Space Station? KC2WGB, KQRIW?
KC2WGB. Yeah, I think I'd try that. That might be a pleasure. If I could pass the medical, yeah, I'd let them shoot me up there.
Because of the fluid pressure in your head, I think you were speculating earlier, Paul, that that's what creates the changes in the vision. I'm going to make a guess that the extra fluid in the eyes creates far-sightedness, expands the envelope of the eye, therefore the lens moves out further from the retina. Let me think about that. Does that make you far-sighted or nearsighted? I think that makes you nearsighted. Yeah. If the same lens is moved out further, you're now focusing at a closer distance. So do the astronauts complain about becoming excessively nearsighted if they spend time in space? Is that approximately the malady, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
It doesn't affect all of them, you know, but it has affected them to the point where they'd like to know what's going on. I don't know if it's there's some kind of stigmatism involved. It changes the shape of your eye, or whether that creates near or far sightedness. I don't know. I mean, at least it's not leading to cataracts or anything. But from what I understand, it's a permanent change. That's what I think is odd. You know, lose pressure just from. You look at the astronauts, their face is all puffy, you can tell. If you look at a ground picture of them and when they're floating in space, the fluids tend to go up to the upper body, and they have all kinds of equipment on board to try to help stabilize that. And, some kind of pressure suit that they get into on board, change the fluids in their body temporarily. There's a lot of work. I mean, that's what I'm saying. They got to work all these problems out to go to Mars. By the way, that machine, that Saboteur machine that creates the water, that keeps breaking down. They've had to send down for valves. They didn't have a replaced special valve that they needed, and they had to come up with another spacecraft. I think one of them came up in SpaceX Dragon. They replaced it. Got a couple more on board. They're trying to figure out how to rebuild the valves in case it happens again. I mean, can you imagine this going on Mars, you know? I mean, at least they were able to get a new valve. You know, you can't send away for another valve, but, you know, when you're halfway to Mars to try to create more water.
If you had a couple of hams on board, Paul, they would insist on having a machine shop on board with a micro lat or whatever the name of that. A miniature lathe, they'd have a real machine shop so that in the worst case situation they can make the parts that they need. That's what you and I would insist on. And, there was another question I was going to ask you. Let's see. Water, air. Oh, yes. When you've got 9 astronauts on board, and there are 2 bathrooms. To my knowledge, there's only 2 bathrooms on the Hold On International Space Station. And one of them occasionally breaks down. Can you imagine if you're left with 1 bathroom and 9 guys on the space station? Do they line up outside of that space station? Line up outside of that bathroom pole? The US-2N, K2RAW?
Yeah, it must have had on board, I think, at one time, with the shell coming up, was 10 or 12. But, you know, the shell has its own bathrooms. In an emergency, you got the Soyuz spacecraft, they have their own bathrooms. And then, I think it was 3. You got one in the Russian segment. It says there you've got one in Unity, which is the node between Destiny and the PMA-1, Pressure Mating Adapter 1, which separates them from the Russians. And I think you had a third one in Tranquility, the one where the machine for separating or for creating water is. One of the cupola. So I think you're up to 3 now. Back to you, Dick.
What is the air pressure inside of the International Space Station? Is it 14.7 pounds per square inch, or is it something lower than that, Paul?
It is 14.7. Yes, it is. That's the number, and they run it pretty close to what is on Earth. That's why they have all that nitrogen. So it's like almost, you know, I'll call it 80 to 20%, you know. It's not exactly like that on Earth, but, you know, they're not adding argon and other, you know, we have other gases here on Earth.
Does the nitrogen get recycled, or the astronauts are breathing in essentially oxygen and nitrogen, and out comes carbon dioxide and nitrogen, I presume? So does the nitrogen just come right back out of the person? Therefore, it's not a clearly defined consumable. You don't have to bring up a whole lot of tanks of nitrogen. Where's the nitrogen coming from? And as you open up a container of nitrogen to make sure you get the right ratio, you're adding extra volume to the air in the space station. Does that mean you vent some of the air overboard so you don't build up an excess pressure? Tell me about nitrogen usage and consumption, if you happen to know. WS2N, K2RAW.
I know very little about what happens when we inhale nitrogen or exhale it. I know you wind up with the bends, and with the nitrogen bubbles expanding too quickly. That's about all I know about what happens with nitrogen in the body. I know there's big tanks of nitrogen. If you go to the Quest lab, it's a pretty large lab. It's 14 foot diameter, maybe about 10 feet forward, and then you have a second compartment, and that's where the actual airlock is. Quest lab is where where they set up to do all the American spacewalks. The Russian spacewalks are done on the Russian side. And surrounding this 14-foot, I'm going to call it about 13, really, probably 13-foot diameter lab on the outside diameter are these tanks that they brought up on the shuttles and attached to the Quest lab. And there looks like about 8 of them, 6 or 8 of them surrounding this thing. And each one is probably got to be 3 feet in diameter, maybe four or five foot long. The shuttles brought these things up, and they have oxygen in them, and they have nitrogen. And that's it. No hydrogen, but oxygen and nitrogen. And whether or not, you know, how nitrogen gets back into these tanks, as you use it, maybe they just add more to the air in the space station. I don't know, Dick. Don't know enough about it. Not a biology expert.
Dick? Yeah, John Rick and Asper, I got another question for you first, John, and that is, I mean, Paul, you have a whole bunch of individual modules up there. Each of those modules has a door that can be closed to close off that module from the rest of the system in a worst-case situation. So because of redundancy, you've got a whole bunch of what I'm going to call bulkhead doors. If in the worst-case situation I close up a whole lot of those bulkhead doors, what maintains the right breathable atmosphere inside of each one of those modules? By what means are they interconnected? When you got all the doors open, yeah, the air is flowing back and forth, no problem. But if you've got to close those bulkhead doors, is there a life support system in each and every one of those modules? Sounds like a lot of redundancy. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, they just went through this not too long ago. They thought they had an ammonia leak. You know, there's ammonia that circulates, goes outside to the radiators to get rid of the heat on board the station. And the computers were coming up and showing that they had, you know, an alarm. You know, they really believed there was a possibility of a leak on the American side. So the three, you know, when they were sleeping quarters, you have, you know, three on one side, and the Russians, you have three on the other side. So, you know, they bailed out, went over to the Russian side, closed the pressure mating adapter door, and that was it. They stayed over there until all was clear, and they realized it was some kind of glitch or some kind of a reading that was coming up that shouldn't have been coming up on the computer. And then we went back inside, and the same thing happened. They saw it. Again, they bailed out, went to the Russian side. Eventually, they cleared it out. But, you know, they're breathing. You know, they have their own air supply on the Russian side. They have these whole electrolysis process going on over there as well. Two locations you can get air from.
Go right ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. Paul mentioned something about right now they're just venting methane. But I believe he said eventually when they get to Mars, they're going to be using methane. Won't they need an oxidizer for that? Otherwise, what are they going to do with it? So that represents an additional amount of oxygen that they're going to have to generate to be able to use methane. What do you think, Dick?
I'm guessing to use methane as a fuel, as a boosting fuel, yes, it's got to be oxidized, and the oxygen is too valuable. Therefore, for the time being, they just vent the methane over the side, is what I think you're saying, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, no way in the world would they be able to, yeah, I know what you mean. No, as a fuel for, like, cooking or something, some other purpose, not, you know, I mean, you would need a tremendous amount of fuel, methane fuel, if you want to launch back into orbit, if that's what we're talking about. That, you know, there is detection of methane on Mars, and that's another story. If they can somehow get a hold of this methane that they seem to be able to pick up on their detectors. In fact, the Indian spacecraft, MOM, that's the one that recently went into orbit that has detected methane. The European Space Agency has the Mars Express. They detected methane. So, they're actually thinking about taking methane out of the atmosphere and creating a fuel eventually for maybe a trip back. I mean, these are things that really have to be investigated before you can actually start building hardware and creating a fueling station on Mars. Back to you, John.
When it comes to orientation of the International Space Station, is that done with reaction control wheels or with reaction control thrusters, similar to the thrusters you had on the space shuttle? Or have they found a way of using movable paddles where the solar wind can do some steering? How do they do three-dimensional or two-dimensional orientation of the International Space Station? Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
They have thrusters on the Progress. They have thrusters on the Soyuz when the Dragon is up there. They have thrusters. I guess they could use that. But, I mean, they do have, apparently, there's thrusters built into the space station. I don't know where they're located. Don't know how they're hooked up. But I know they do have thrusters on board the space station itself. When they say that, they might be just talking about the thrusters on the Zesda module, the main module. I think that's really what they're talking about. And the, you know, living quarters for the Russians. I think that's what's going on there, Dick. You asked something else, man. I forgot.
Well, what is the fuel that's used for those thrusters? Whatever that fuel is, it's a consumable. And if they could have done it with reaction wheels that are powered by the solar voltaic panels, that's a non-consumable. That's a renewable resource. So what do you believe those, what is the fuel that's used with those thrusters? Is it nitrazine and nitrous oxide, you know, the fancy rocket fuel, overuse bulb, K2LIW?
Yeah, I know that highly corrosive fuel, so I don't know if how, you know, what the life is of that. I know it's at least 6 months because the spacecraft, well, you know, the Russians anyway are attached. In fact, the European Space Agency are attached with the probably for 6 months. So I guess it's okay to use that I think it's called hydrazine fuel. That's what they use. On board the station, they have gyros, and I don't think they have momentum wheels to make any kind of movement, because in the Z1 truss segment that's located right above Destiny, it's a small, maybe one-third of the size of all the other trusses that are up there. Inside, they have four gyroscopes. And that keeps the whole space station steady. They do use them. They're very large, from what I understand. Very large gyroscopes in this spinning thing. In fact, they had to do a EVA one time into that to do it. And they needed to put a spacesuit on to go into that area. You know, it's a closed area, but it's depressurized with these spinning gyros. So they, I know they got gyros. As far as moving the solar arrays around, yes, they'll do that. They'll put them at a certain angle, and you can get some kind of movement with that. You can have the space station go faster or slower by changing the orientation of the solar panel.
Boy, wouldn't it nice if the solar panels could give you enough thrust that you wouldn't need boosting? I know that's out of the question. You had another question, John. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I believe Paul is right. Hydrazine is extremely corrosive, difficult to handle. I mean, that goes back to the Germans and their first jets, so that may be what they're using up there, Dick. Back to you, sir.
The ammonia leak they worried about, which I guess is part of the refrigeration system, cooling system, I'd like to believe that ammonia is something that your nose, that your nose would detect very soon. However, when your nose detects the ammonia, is it already at a toxic level? Is that why they got fancy sensors for that simple? US2M, K2LAW?
I guess the sensors are going to pick it up before your nose. But I can talk from personal experience. I got involved with the ammonia leak in Denver, Colorado when I was working there, and it felt like somebody took a long pointy screwdriver and jammed it up my nose. It was, wow, it's pretty powerful. So you'll know it right away. The ammonia, it's used for the cooling system. I don't want to call it a refrigeration system. There's no compressor going on. You know, there's no high side and low side. There's no evaporation going on with the in the ammonia system. Like you think of a, you know, they have an ammonia refrigeration systems here on Earth, which are truly refrigeration systems, high side, low side, and compressors in between, evaporators, condensers. But you don't have that on the space station. It's a liquid ammonia that's pumped to the radiators, and inside the space station there's a heat exchanger, and they'll take the heat from the heat exchanger and remove it, physically pump it outside. The reason it's ammonia, you can't use anything else, it would probably freeze real quick, like glycol or anything like that. They'd love to be able to use that, but they can't. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so it's a fluid that conducts thermal energy from point A to point B, and it's got to be pumped to do that. Boy, wouldn't it be nice if you could use very large, I can't think of the name of these darn things, thermal pipes, if you know what I mean. John, what's the name of these pipes where you've got a wicked fluid inside and it conducts energy, heat from pipes? A what?
The convection tubes?
Let's call it a heat pipe. Wouldn't it be nice if that was a passive heat pipe? But I guess the problem is that the heat pipe really works by change of state. And so would the ammonia survive these crazy temperatures you get between the backside of the Earth, dark side versus non-backside? A heat pipe would be awful nice as opposed to pumping the ammonia. And I guess you're saying that they don't know of any other fluid that could be used as a cooling fluid that wouldn't be freezing and boiling on them. WS2N, K2RIW.
When you're thinking of a heat pipe, are you thinking of an evaporator and a condenser system? Is that what you're thinking of? It would be great if they could use that. I think ammonia is around 500 BTU per pound of water. Water is 900 something. Yeah, that would be great. Is that what you're thinking about, or some other system?
A comment, Dick.
Yeah, there are a number of computers and other pieces of electronics that use a device called a heat pipe. It literally is a hollow copper pipe where inside it contains a confined fluid with a wicking paper around the perimeter of the pipe. And so at the hot end, the fluid inside is boiling off. At the cold end of the heat pipe, it's condensing back into a liquid and being wicked back by way of the, let's call it filter paper or blotting paper that's around the inside.
I think it's a capillary tube system.
It's not necessarily capillary, but what I'm getting at is a well-designed heat pipe can conduct heat something like 10 or 20 times better than a solid copper rod of the same dimensions. So that change of state inside gives a tremendous ability to dump heat with very little delta temperature between the hot end and the cold end. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
It's like the heat radiators that they're using on the station.
And yeah, very good. Now, think about this. The ammonia system that we use here on Earth, we have ammonia systems that operate from a gas flame instead of a compressor. So maybe what they're doing is they're using the differential temperature to warm the ammonia on one side, and just like hydronic flow, you'll have the ammonia flow. And that's what's happening in the heat pipes too, I believe, Dick. Differential temperature.
So maybe what we're talking about here are heat pipes, and maybe the change of state substance inside of them is ammonia. And so they worry about one of their heat pipes springing a leak and the ammonia coming out. Maybe that's what's going on here. Over to you, Paul. Comment, Dick?
Yeah, but that definitely doesn't turn into a gas. The ammonia always stays liquid in this whole ISS system. So if that's what your heat pump is doing, then your heat pipe is doing, then no, it couldn't be. If it stays a liquid, yes. Back to you.
But a hydraulic system, it does stay a liquid like water. It's just the difference in temperature that causes the flow. Back to you, Dick.
Am I hearing Roy there? AC2GS, if so, go right ahead.
So this is Mike, K1MJM.
Go right ahead, Mike, number two.
Roger, K1MJM. Yeah, they do use ammonia, and they use it in extruded aluminum heat pipes in satellites. It's common.
So I think think, Mike, you're speculating that maybe the International Space Station has heat pipes that are using ammonia as a change of state fluid. Is that a guess on your part, Mike?
I can't tell you for sure with the space station, but I do know that they use it in other satellites. It's common in hydrous ammonia and aluminum heat pipes, extruded aluminum heat pipes, yes.
By the way, Dick, let me tell Mike, check out that Hawaii Stripe launch system. I know you're big on those sounding type rockets. Well, this one's going into orbit. If you haven't done it already, Mike.
Okay, thank you. I will.
Okay, in about 30 seconds, we're about to be cut off. This was TechNet number 1549 of the series, began in September of 1982. And we've had a lot more fun with the space stuff this week. Hey, John, say some closing words, John. KC2WGV, K2IW.
Very good, Dick. Yes, and short. I want to thank everybody. Wonderful people that come in here with this information, and it's always great. Love to hear it, and I hope everybody can make it back next week. And I'll just give you my email address. It's Juliet Bravo 5 Oscar Oscar at AOL.com. If anyone has a question, would like to pose to the net, just email me a question, and I'll make sure it gets through there. Paul, maybe you'd like to give your email. Thanks, John. Yeah, I forgot. It's a spacenetreport@gmail.com. Dick, over to you.
Okay. We made it before we got chopped off. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. And there's an awful lot to learn about wireless electronics. You think that you've heard it all with our 1,549 TechNets? Not a chance. We've done a little more than scratch the surface. There's more where that came from. Bye-bye, you all. Hey, what's going on, Shane? Bye-bye, you all. See you next week.
Oh, 1-2-4. Wait to CDO. The delay.
Yeah, because of that delay, we're going to call you the late Andy. The B2 CDO, K2RIW.
No. I'm not late. That's the people who are dead. Yeah, I'm listening to myself coming back. I just finished watching the news. Hello?
Any new breakthroughs in the news that we should know about, Andy?
No news is good news, so everything is good.
Sounds good. See you later, sir.
Did you already know you went one?
I guess we beat it over 12. Okay, see you later. Talk to you at WCDU.
N1YDY, K2RIW. I think the answer is yes. Let me do a little bit more checking and I'll get back to you.
AC2WGB, NY28. Yeah, good morning. So I resolved my noise problem. So what it was the cable coming out of the 706 CIV cable, and it's being used currently on HF amplifier on transmit. And it comes into a little box to electronics and that. So that was right on the rig, so I just redressed it a little bit. Well, now, went away.
Sounds perfect right now. No problem, no noise at all. So, yeah, you nailed it.
Yeah. Got off easy. I just wanted you to know that because we were with it last night. Ready? A good one. And white. Tonight at 8:30, W2VL repeater system.
for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active. System.